This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Well, I think that I want to thank those who invited me here to give this talk tonight, and I had the pleasure of sitting in at some of the earlier sessions today and seeing that you guys have been inundated with a lot of information about Islam and Muslims. And in that context, I'm sort of reminded, as I stand here on the precipice of delivering my own barrage of information, of a figure from Middle Eastern folklore, a fellow by the name of Juha. And he's a sort of all-purpose figure. If you're a Turk, he's a Turk. If you're an Arab, he's an Arab. If you're a Persian, he's a Persian. But at any rate, once Juha was invited to the local mosque to give a talk, and he got up and mounted the rostrum and looked out at the people and said to them, do you know what I'm going to talk about? And they said to him, yes. And Juha says then, well, if you know what I'm going to talk about, there's no need for me to talk about it. And he left. Well, he came back the next day, asked again to address the congregation, and mounted the rostrum and looked out at the audience and said, do you know what I'm going to talk about? And of course, remembering the experience of the previous day, they looked back at him and said, no. And Juha said, well, then if you don't know what I'm going to talk about, there's no need for me to talk about it. And he left. And then he came back on the third day, once again asked to address the congregation, and he looked out at the audience and said, do you know what I'm going to talk about today? And this time, half the audience said yes, and the other half said no, thinking that they had stumped old Juha. At that point, Juha looked back at them and said, let those who know tell those who don't know what I'm going to talk about, and he left. And I'll tell you, it's tempting. let me begin by saying that I sort of took my assignment from Diane Winston in our telephone conversation somewhat literally, and I understood that to be to come and say a few words about Muslims in America and somehow tie that together with the issue of the representation of Muslims and Islam in the media. I've also tried to integrate into my presentation tonight what I anticipated to be some of the questions that would emerge out of earlier discussions in the day. And what I do not cover in that regard, hopefully we can deal with in the question and answer period. And I'm assuming that there will be a question and answer period. I'm going to have to do something about this thing, though, because it... Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so, all right. All right, so who are the Muslims in America? They are, in sum, an amalgamation of races, ethnicities, classes, and, perhaps most importantly, histories, bound together by a common commitment to a set of basic religious / theological postulates, and an ongoing exchange in word and deed about what those religious and theological postulates mean in the context of their desire for a dignified and self-respecting existence as Muslims in America. I'll say that again for those who have that look on their face. The Muslims in America are an amalgamation of races, ethnicities, classes, and histories bound together by a common commitment to a set of basic religious and theological postulates and an ongoing exchange in words and in deeds about what these religious and theological postulates mean in the context of their desire for a dignified and self-respecting existence as Muslims in America. It is this conversation or exchange about the meaning of their commitment to these religious theological postulates that really defines the lives of these people and their status as a Muslim collectivity in America. Now, let me say a few words about these basic religious and theological postulates. The first and most important of which is, of course, the dictum that there is no God except God, or Allah in Arabic, and that Muhammad is his messenger. Two, this implies, of course, the authority of the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet, that is to say, his normative teaching, application, and supplement to the Quran. It also includes, however, or implies, a certain role for tradition, or the manner in which the early community processed, prioritized, understood, and applied the data contained in the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet. Indeed, traditionally, this has been understood to be among the most reliable reflections of what the Prophet himself actually taught. Now, for our purposes, two important and fundamental questions emerge out of this commitment to these basic religious and theological principles. One, how far does the era of sacred history extend beyond the time of the Prophet and his followers? Is it limited to the generation of the Prophet? Is it one generation after the Prophet, two generations after the Prophet, 2 centuries after the Prophet? How far into the future does that period of sacred history extend? The second question is, who are the custodians and the authoritative interpreters of that sacred history and tradition? Now, in the classical period, in pre-modern times, both of these questions found relatively clear answers. Sacred history extended for the first 3 generations or so after the Prophet Muhammad, and then gradually faded out, ultimately coming to an end sometime around the 4th century of the Islamic calendar, the 10th century of the Common Era. This is indeed the most important period in Muslim history, for it is through applying the Quran and the Sunnah to the realities of this particular historical period that normative understandings of Islam emerge. In other words, it is by trying to get the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet to speak to historical realities of the first 3 centuries or so following the death of the Prophet that the real normative meanings of Islam, of Scripture, of the Quran, of the Sunnah, that is the period during which these meanings emerge. As a consequence of this, all subsequent history of Islam, in order to be able to authenticate itself, would have to seek to do so through a conversation of sorts with this sacred period of history. This is to say that no group and no articulation of Islam that aspired to anything beyond a fleeting existence could afford to try to vindicate itself outside of a conversation with this particular era of Muslim history. You might get articulations of Islam that come on the scene and die out. You get a little explosion here, a flash in the pan there. But any real permanency to any expression of Islam would have to seek to authenticate itself, vindicate itself, in conversation with this sacred period of Islam of the first 3 centuries or so. As a result, it is not simply, and one has to be careful in the way one says this, because it can raise certain sensitivities with regard to the way that Islam is expressed rhetorically, oftentimes, by Muslims. But in actuality, it is not simply the Quran and the Sunnah that define the parameters of Islam. It is not the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet alone that define the parameters of Islam. To the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet one must add the dictates of this sacred history. And let me try to give you an example of what I'm talking about here. If we take the Quran and the Sunnah alone, there are all kinds of possibilities that could emerge out of these documents in terms of the language alone. All right? So for example, I could, on a literalistic reading of the Quran, justify a man having 9 wives. The Quran says what? Marry them 3 and 4. I'm sorry, 2 and 3 and 4. That's the literal quote from the Quran. Well, 2 plus 3 is 5. Plus 4 is 9. No Muslim, however, no matter how literal they would claim to be, would accept this interpretation. And that is because that interpretation was banished from the purview of consideration during the period of sacred history, when the parameters of normative meaning, of normative understandings, were being set. Okay? I could, on a literal reading of the Quran, justify, for example, Muslims eating pork. If you can believe that. The Quran says that the food of the people of the book has been made lawful to you. It's the food of Jews and Christians has been made lawful to you. And therefore, and on a literal interpretation, pork consumption would be lawful to Muslims. No Muslim, no matter how literal they claim to be, will accept this interpretation. And it's not because the words of the Quran or of the Sunnah of the Prophet cannot accommodate that interpretation, but it's because the period of sacred history banished that interpretation from the purview of consideration. To reiterate again, part of what's going on in modern Islam is a continuation of the process of seeking to vindicate one's articulation of Islam through a conversation with the parameters of acceptable doctrine that emerged out of the period of sacred history. And no group of Muslims who expects to have any permanency to their articulation of Islam can afford to ignore the necessity of putting itself in conversation with that sacred history. Earlier today, someone mentioned the whole question of progressive Muslims, a movement among certain groups of Muslims in America, and why it came crashing to the ground. Well, one of the reasons, and I would argue that the primary reason, was that the progressive Muslim movement did not take seriously the necessity of vindicating itself, of placing itself in conversation with the period of sacred history of Islam. And for that reason, it could not sustain itself within the collective body of Muslims in America. Now, that's the whole issue of the time period of sacred history. Who were the custodians of this sacred history? Who were the authoritative interpreters of this sacred history? It was, in a word, the fuqaha, or the doctors of Islamic law. On this, there has been virtually no disagreement, both within and without the Muslim community. Islam developed as a nomocratic civilization in which the doctors of the law had the most authoritative discourse and therefore had the authority to define the parameters of acceptable doctrine more so than anyone else in Muslim society. A number of things emerged out of the activity of the doctors of the law. One, they developed processes and mechanisms for accreditation or authentication. That is to say, who was qualified to be looked upon as a doctor of the law. I mean, they had training programs, they had examinations, they had degree granting processes that were designed to uphold a certain standard of due diligence that was to be applied to the whole enterprise of scriptural interpretation. So only someone who went through a certain type of education and received a certain type of authentication was looked upon as an authoritative interpreter of the religious law. And by law, I mean theology as well. Okay? That's the first thing. Two, the doctors of the law developed what I call a public reason. That is to say, an interpretive methodology by which interpretations of Scripture could be validated. That is to say, the real authority of an interpretation resided not simply in the fact that a doctor of the law was expressing it, but in the fact that he could vindicate it by reference to agreed upon methodologies of scriptural interpretation. And so the real authority lied in this public reason, this legal methodology, not necessarily in the person of the jurist or the doctor of the law himself. Moreover, any opinion that could be validated on the basis of this interpretive methodology was considered acceptable, valid, plausible. This, and I feel really bad here now because I understand that you've been bombarded by this talk about diversity in Islam. Well, it's a fact we're going to have to live with. This particular setup gave rise to a massive diversity of opinion in the pre-modern period. And these are diverse opinions, all of which mutually recognize each other as being at the very least plausible. All right? Give me an idea of just how much diversity there was. In the 4th century, there was a man by the name of Ibn al-Munzir, the 4th, 10th century of the Common Era, who published a book entitled The Book of Consensus that contained all of the issues on which the doctors of the law had reached a unanimous consensus. This book turned out to be, the Saudis republished an edition of this book back in the 80s, I think it was, turned out to be something like 139 pages. And for those of you who don't know, the Saudis are very friendly to people like myself who have to wear reading glasses. They have this large print. They're famous for using large Arabic print. So it was 139 pages of large Arabic print. A contemporary of Ibn al-Munzir, the famous Quranic exegete, a man by the name of al-Tabari, who died 8 years before Ibn al-Munzir, published another book called The Book of Disagreement. And this book contained all the issues on which the doctors of the law disagreed. That book came out to be 3,000 pages in manuscript. I mean, that's an idea of just how much diversity existed then. All right? Okay, finally, the other, for our purposes here, thing to be considered about the rise of the doctors of the law is that during the period of sacred history and all the way up to modern times, the doctors of the law exercised a virtual monopoly on literacy. And this was one of the issues, one of the means that sustained and helped them sustain their power and their authority as authoritative interpreters of the law. They were the only ones virtually who had access to this discourse, all right? And before the rise of the printing press, even access to books, all right? So that gives us an idea of how the custodians of the era of sacred history were positioned. Now, this scenario continues all the way right up to modern times, at which time it is disrupted. Modernity exerts many effects, but for our purposes here, I think the most important of these is the simultaneous marginalization of the interpretive authority of the traditional doctors of the law by the modern Muslim state. That is to say, law in classical pre-modern Islam, certainly in terms of determining the substance of the law, was pretty much a sub-state activity. Does everybody understand what I mean by that? Doctors of the law who were independent of the state determined what the substance of the law was. With the rise of the modern nation state, the state takes over the definition of the law. This has the effect of marginalizing the traditional doctors of the law in terms of their legal authority, their authority to define what the law is. At the same time, there is the vacuum that is, in a sense, developed out of this situation is filled by the fact that modernity also witnesses the rise of massive literacy on the part of the population. So on the one hand, you get the traditional doctors of the law with their highly sort of formalized training marginalized. On the other hand, you get mass literacy, all right, and mass access to books, all right? And so all of a sudden, we have a very different reading, literate public, all right, before books about Islam, about Islamic doctrine, about Islamic law, about Islamic theology, and all of these things. And this has a massive impact on the sort of manner by which doctrine is produced in the modern world. In a sense, this vacuum of authority results in something of an interpretive free-for-all. And that results in a global authority crisis in modern Islam. And this raises the question, who speaks for Islam? Now, one of the biggest mistakes that one can make, I think, in looking at Islam in the modern world is, of course, to assume that the realities of the modern Muslim world are simply an uninterrupted continuation of the classical period. That is a major mistake, with catastrophic implications in terms of our ability to understand what is going on. In this regard, I'd like to relate to you a real-life incident that I experienced a few years ago in Egypt. I was in Cairo, I was about to leave the country, and I wanted to pick up a copy of a very famous modern explanation of the Quran by a very controversial figure, the firebrand Sayyid Qutb, who was at one time the chief ideologue of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, this work is six volumes, big tomes, and it's a very important work in certain ways, but I mean, I wanted it basically as a reference. I go into the store and I say, I'd like to have a copy of Sayyid Qutb, and he says, okay, £125. That's not a whole lot of money, but when in Cairo, you act like the Cairenes. And so I plunge into my spiel, you know, why, Eda, Lee, you know. And the guy sort of starts getting just a little bit impatient. He says, okay, look here. If you want, I can go in the back and I can get you a copy of another explanation of the Quran by a classical exegete, the very famous Ibn Kathir. It's a very famous tafsir. And he said, not the abridged version, the full version. I can give it to you for £75. But if you don't take this particular edition of Sayyid Qutb off the shelf now, today, if you come back tomorrow, I'll have to order it for you. It won't be there. I said to him, wait a minute. Ibn Kathir? Sayyid Qutb? Why? He said the following to me. He said, the people won't buy Ibn Kathir because they are afraid of him. They can't read him. He makes them feel stupid. He has all this classical poetry in there, all these grammatical explanations. They don't have access to this. Sayyid Qutb, on the other hand, he writes in very accessible modern Arabic and relates everything in his explanation to modern events in the Muslim world. By virtue, therefore, of access alone, Sayyid Qutb, who was not a trained exegete or a jurist, has the potential of displacing a highly authoritative classical exegete from the classical period. All right? Sayyid Qutb's radical and in some ways, I don't want to make him the issue, so in some ways belligerent, almost, interpretations of Islam, of the Quran, many of which would be either modified or undermined by the tafsir or the explanation of Ibn Kathir, all right, are given a much broader hearing simply because people have access to him. Not necessarily because they prefer his views, although they may. They simply can't read Ibn Kathir. That is a part of what is going on in the Muslim world. So much so that a colleague of mine, Professor Dick Bullitt, at the Columbia University, refers to the authority crisis in modern Islam as being one in which authority now is often confused with and replaced by authorship. In other words, if you want to be an authority, all you have to do is write. And your authority is not, it's no longer based on the level of training or authentication that you might have from a seminary or anything like that. It's based simply on the fact that you are able to write. And so authority now is often confused with authorship. Now, this is the general picture that characterizes much, and I think the most important aspects of what is going on in the Muslim world. Let's move for the moment, and I'm trying to rush through this because I realize I have, yes, limited time. Let's move then to America. What does this tell us about Islam in America? Now, the authority crisis in American Islam is exacerbated, to put it lightly. We have, on the one hand, and going back to my initial statement about Muslims in America being an amalgamation of different races, ethnicities, classes, histories, there is a competition for ownership in Islam in America. Who will own Islam? Who will be looked upon as having the authority to define and speak for Islam? The immigrant community has sort of led in the charge to pretensions of ownership. Now, to be fair, this is prima facie a quite reasonable sort of assumption. After all, if these people from the Muslim world are not Muslims, then who is? All right? Having said that much, in many instances, and more than would often meet the eye, the true basis of the immigrant pretension to authority or ownership is not religious knowledge per se, but rather their rootedness in a history that is presumed to be Islamic because it is presumed and often presented as being an uninterrupted continuation of the history that emerges out of the era of sacred history. And so what we're really looking at in some instances are competing histories. Whose history is both most authentic and therefore has the greatest claim of being the history in contemplation of which normative understandings of the Quran and Sunnah should emerge. Do we get those normative understandings by trying to apply the Quran and the Sunnah to American reality, or do we get normative understandings by trying to apply the Quran and the Sunnah to Middle Eastern, and let me be more precise, Arab realities? This is a part of the competition that's going on in American Islam. And let me be clear here, very clear. This is not simply the contention of black American Muslims. White American Muslims feel the same way in many regards. Second and third generation immigrant Muslims feel the same way in many regards. There is a feeling that American history and social reality is discounted as the proper object of Muslim religious contemplation. And that if you really want to be authentic in your thinking, you contemplate the realities of the Muslim world, you come to solutions in that context, and then analogically, you see, you apply that to life in the States. But you do not interpret or attempt to apply Islam directly to life in the United States. And this is all, again, connected to the authority crisis. Now, the presumption that the history of the modern world is a faithful reflection of the legacy of Islam produces the following. The Muslim world, number one, is where real Islam exists. And when I say Muslim world, again, more properly speaking, I should say the Arab Muslim world. Two, the Muslim world has the exclusive capacity to authenticate those who have pretensions to Islam. This is an extremely important issue here. And this is what is behind what I call in other contexts the John Walker Lind syndrome. If one thinks about why John Walker Lind would leave America and go to the Muslim world to begin with, the answer is that so that he could get validation, so that he could be authenticated. The other side of that is that Islam in America struggles and continues to struggle with the fact that American Islam is not yet self-authenticating. All right? It still derives a good measure of its authenticity from the Muslim world. All right? And then lastly, it is only in contemplation, therefore, of Scripture in light of the realities of the modern Muslim world, as I mentioned earlier, that normative understandings of Islam can emerge. All right? And this has the effect of sort of putting Muslims in America in a position where this is sort of a scrimmage game here in America. The real league is in still the Muslim world. Now, there are a number of Muslims in America who are pushing back against this. The black American community is pushing back against this and arguing that, for example, just one example, if the issue of Palestine and the occupied territories can claim the status of being a bona fide Islamic issue, why cannot then racial discrimination, white supremacy, the problems of the urban ghetto, all right, make an equal claim to being a bona fide Islamic issue that deserves the attention and the intellectual energy of the Muslim community? All right? And I'll follow up on Josh's shameless plug. This is essentially, you should know that academics don't make any money off these books, but I think this is an extremely important discourse about this very problem. Because this book is about trying to get Muslims in America, as well as non-Muslims in America, to take seriously the prospect of Islam in America as being part of the ongoing saga of the American project. That Islam is, you know, people don't realize this, but if you just take the African-American community as a whole, the proto-Islamic movements of the 20th century got started at the beginning of the 20th century. There's almost 100 years that's passed on Islam in the black American community as an American phenomenon. I'm not talking about, you know, Islam coming over on slave ships. No, Islam has begun in America. Almost 100 years has passed on that very enterprise. And so Islam as part of the American project. White Americans are also pushing back. All right? They come from a history. And by the way, we tend to over-politicize our thinking about Islam. Muslims are not always just concerned about political issues. I mean, simple issues like the celebration of holidays. You know, someone converts to Islam, they come from a Christian background or whatever. Can we celebrate Thanksgiving? Can men wear wedding bands? Can people celebrate birthdays? All right? And again, the tension is, okay, do we answer this question on the basis of an analogous examination of what goes on in the Muslim world and say, well, whatever they celebrate, we can celebrate? Or is the discussion one of, let's look at what the Quran and the Sunnah and sacred history says and process these issues on the basis of that? That is really what's going on in this capacity. I'm going to hurry up because we make each other nervous. All right. The third group, there are growing numbers of immigrant Muslims who are also pushing back. And I don't want to give the impression that, you know, attachment to the pretensions of Islam being located solely in the Muslim world is exclusively an immigrant thing. There are many white Americans and black Americans who also subscribe to that notion, or that all immigrants subscribe to that picture. They do not. We've already mentioned the progressives, put in quotations. There are also intelligent, committed immigrant Muslims. And I think that we saw an example of this morning in Essam Abdallah, who actually evolved into some of the positions that you hear articulated today. And that has been a process that has unfolded over years of having lived in America and having therefore been in a position to develop a more critical position vis-a-vis the realities of the Muslim world. Also, second and third generation immigrant kids are pushing back against the sort of hegemonic pretensions of the Muslim world. And then finally, women in all of these groups are pushing back. Now, all of this has been accelerated and informed by the events of 9/11. And while all of these groups in their attempts to sort of push back, as it were, may achieve this or that success on this or that issue, the real determining factor in terms of what kind of Islam emerges in America is, in my opinion, very intimately connected with these groups' success at vindicating their perspective and their perspective as Muslims who live in America through a conversation with that sacred history that I talked about earlier. That is going to determine, in terms of the long-term implications of Islam in America, what kind of Islam emerges. Now, if I can take just 2 minutes, I'll say just a couple of words about this whole media thing, because I think it's both fair and important for us to understand a few things in this regard. Muslims, as I guess you might imagine, have a certain amount of difficulty with the media and media representations of Islam. A lot of this is connected to the all-too-human preference for being represented by one's ideals as opposed to one's realities. I don't think that Muslims are the only ones who have this perspective. But I think that there are real ways in which Muslims feel that both their ideals and their realities are often distorted, and sometimes through what appears to be an almost willful ignorance. And just let me give two examples, one of ideals being distorted and the other of realities being distorted, and then I'll try and wrap up. Muslims feel that their ideals are often distorted because their ideals are routinely, if not exclusively, put into conversation not with the teachings of other religions, but with secular enlightenment ideology and all its attitudes and biases towards religion. And in this context, Muslims feel that they are rarely in a position of simply being able to explain or articulate what Islam is. Instead, they are placed in a sort of hegemonic discourse that always seems to put them in the position of having to apologize. And of course, when you apologize, you're always in a position of having your views distorted, because there's a certain thrust to apologies that communicates a certain kind of meaning. So when I ask you, well, have you stopped beating your wife yet? I mean, how are you going to... And so Muslims really feel that they are more often than not put in a position of having to apologize rather than being simply able to explain. And by the way, in terms of sources, this leads to the problem of you guys coming in contact with misinformation and in some instances willful, outright untruths. All right? Under pressure to apologize and to make Islam seem, or the ideals of Islam, appear more seemly in the context of a universe of meanings that is secular and enlightenment informed. All right? Maybe doing the question and answer period, but I'll explain why. I mean, this is what led, in a sense, to the fatwa about terrorism, and this is precisely why a person such as myself resigned. Okay? Because what was happening was that the integrity of the Fifth Council was being undermined. The Fifth Council was taking a political position. It was talking about what it liked to see, what it didn't like to see. That's not the position of a Fifth Council. A Fifth Council is supposed to engage solely in principled deductions of the law. Sort of like when you see the Supreme Court at the President's State of the Union address. And he makes this point and everybody stands up and claps, and the Supreme Court does what? They sit there still. We don't have an opinion because we need to maintain your confidence that we will engage in our job in an unbiased manner. And if we're already giving a sense of what we think, how can you have confidence that we've interpreted the Constitution in an objective manner? The Fifth Council, all right, by coming out, I didn't have any problem with the substance of the fatwa, per se, against terrorism. I've written academic pieces out of the classical tradition on terrorism and jihad that, you know, ban all of them from the perspective of Islamic law. All right? But for the Fifth Council to simply say, okay, look at us, Homeland Security, see, we're really nice guys, and we're going to contemn terrorism because we know that's what you really, really want to hear, and we're not going to give any arguments, we're not going to give any verses from the Quran, we're not going to give anything from the Sunnah or anything, just accept us. That, to me, undermines the integrity of the Fifth Council and forestalls the point at which you can actually develop an institution in American Islam that can command the respect of the Muslim populace. This is a very serious problem from my perspective. One of the things that I worry about, there's one minute and I promise I'll stop. One of the things that I worry about is for those who are seeking to present Islam to the American populace at large, getting out too far ahead of the rank and file of Muslims, of not taking the time to vindicate their points of view, of getting the Muslims themselves on board when they talk about democracy or women or voting or this or that particular financial instrument. All right? Because when that happens, what you're going to get is a disconnect between leadership and the populace. And that's a very real fear of mine. Last point, and I promise and we'll be done. I've said that several times. Anyway, the issue of the realities of the Muslim community being distorted. The realities of the Muslim community, Muslims feel, are distorted in as much as only for Muslims are their realities taken as being faithful reflections of their ideals. That is to say that, you know, Al-Qaeda or whomever gets in a plane and crashes into a building, all right? That's a reality. No one denies that. But is it reflective of the ideals of Islam? Here with Muslims, people take it to be a reflection of the ideal of jihad. I teach a class at the University of Michigan, comparative religion class. Last time I taught it was about 456 students. I asked the question, if I, as a black American Muslim, got into my car and crashed into the front office of the local KKK, just drove my car right into the office, killed everybody inside, how many people would believe that I did that because I'm a Muslim and they're a Christian? None of them said they would believe that. I said then, how about if I stated that I did it because I'm a Muslim and they're Christians? Still, they wouldn't believe it. What if I quoted you the verses from the Quran that said, slay them wherever you find them? Would you believe then that I did it because I'm a Muslim and they're a Christian? Still, they would not believe it. Yet, we have no problem believing that Islam, some normative understanding of Islam, is what motivated 9/11. The difference, again, is that white Americans, my fellow Americans, know my history. We don't know very much about the history of the Muslim world, and therefore we don't know what kinds of considerations might inform their behavior in the same way that we know the kinds of considerations that might inform my own. I'll stop there. My apologies, and thank you very much. Yes and no.
And then when it comes here, and then when it comes to the United States, there's that friction that's going on within the immigrant community and then with the Black American community.
Yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of considerations. I mean, one of the real challenges that Islam poses to Muslim Americans is that, you're right, in many instances, Muslims from certain parts of the world have, by and large, interactions with only Muslims of their sort of ethnicity, class, and linguistic group, even their particular persuasion of Islam. So, for example, Indian and Pakistani Muslims are very much into the Hanafi school of law and practices, and that's basically all they recognize as being Islam. And then all of a sudden they come to America, right? And, for example, I mean, Hanafis pray with their hands like this, all right? The Maliki school prays the right way, with their hands down to their sides like that. Now, you can imagine what, you know, someone from the subcontinent thinks, feels, and what. So there are those kinds of tensions that are there. I'm not sure I would call it nationalistic, because I think that it depends on the issue with which they're being confronted. In terms of whether some sort of nativistic sentiment or impulse will flare up or not. It's sort of like, you know, blacks in America have lots of infighting, but Trent Lott says something outrageous, and then everybody's together. You know, so I mean, the same thing. The same thing applies to Muslims from various parts and various countries within the Muslim world.
Okay, yeah, just are the Saudis basically trying to be the top dog because they have the money and they can fund the mosques, et cetera, in America?
I would say that, and I'm going to speak here in as neutral a fashion as I can. I would argue that any country in the Muslim world that felt that it could exert influence over the development and therefore the sense of I don't want to call it loyalty but affiliation that emerges out of America would jump at the chance to do that. The Saudis happen to be more particularly, I think, favorably positioned than other countries. They do have the money. They have control of the visas for Hajj. They have the Hajj. And they have a religious establishment that is quite large and active. I mean, I think from Philadelphia. I mean, that's my hometown. And you know there, among the Salafi movement, I mean, there is an enormous amount of influence. But there are other parts of the country in which Al-Azhar in Egypt, for example, seeks to influence. One of the things that I think about, and I'm just wondering about this, is the following, that within the Black American community, Shiism has had a very, very, very limited success. Very, 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 very few African Americans are Shiites. And one of the reasons for this is that Shiism has by and large been represented by Persian-speaking Iran. With the invasion of Iraq and with the toppling of the Sunni regime in Iraq, first of all, you produce a Shi arc that now runs from Iran all the way to Lebanon. All right? And for the first time, you're going to have an Arabic-speaking, oil-rich Shi country. Now, what implications is that going to have for the ability of Shiism to exploit itself in its Arab guise, all right, as opposed to the Persian guise that the Iranians sort of were shouldered with in terms of trying to export Shiism from Iran? That has massive implications. I mean, you could be looking at a situation where, you know, Arabic books are flowing into America, and American Muslims can't tell whether the authors are Shiite or Sunni. I mean, this has potentially far-reaching implications. I don't know, but it's a question. Karima.
You were talking about the traditional texts and how important they were in terms of forming normative Islam. Can you talk a little bit about the influence of Isra'iyat and how that kind of twisted things, frankly? I think a perfect example for me as a female is the issue of Adam and Eve and the blame of the fall, that Eve in the Quran is never blamed, mm-hmm. specifically. I mean, it's Adam and Eve or it's Adam, but never Eve. But you get the Isra'iyat and suddenly these, I can see people to this day still quoting these things that go completely in the face of Islam.
Yeah, but again, I'll give you one of my personal scholarly biases here. I don't know how much it's worth in terms of your enterprise of reporting on Islam, but I happen to think that the emphasis on texts is somewhat exaggerated. What's really going on is that people are appealing to texts in an effort to validate certain histories. All right? And it's really the history, all right, of, you know, let's say very conservative communities, let's say in Pakistan or India or you know, in Yemen or something like that, that would point to these kinds of sources as a means of validating a social practice that's very, very common among them. All right? But it's very doubtful that that practice is a spontaneous result of interpreting that particular hadith. If matters were that simple, all right, we'd have a much, I mean, people somehow think that, well, all you have to do is come up with the right interpretation and it will change everything. Well, Muslims drink. Is there any interpretation that says Muslims can drink? I mean, Muslims do all kinds of things, for which there is no interpretation. So I think that the Israeliyat are somewhat of a problem in as much as they provide a basis, all right, for certain groups to try and authenticate their practices. But the practices themselves, I think in a minority of cases, they don't actually emanate from those sources. You get the point that I'm trying to make. Yeah, there is a justificationism. Well, my point is that even if that particular source did not exist, the attempt would be through some other source.
Is that a person, Israeliyat? What is that?
Israeliyat is a genre of hadith when Islam spread out into other parts of the Middle East, it encountered any number of Jewish converts, and the Jewish converts themselves brought in apocryphal material from their own backgrounds and sort of reformulated them in the guise of hadith and placed them in the mouth of the prophet, and some of these things seeped into the corpus of hadith. And that's what she's talking about there.
I feel like I'm still trying to get a handle on who the custodians and interpreters of the law are today. I mean, I understand there are these doctors of the law, but as a journalist, I'm still trying to figure out who are the wise people. Do they exist today? And what do we, who do we rely on as journalists as our interpreters and custodians?
Well, the honest question to that is I don't know. And that is because we are, as I said, in the midst of an authority crisis. I mean, that question is no more difficult for you, trust me, than it is for the average Muslim. The average Muslim is at a real loss in terms of determining, well, who exactly do I listen to? And this is one of the reasons that by default, oftentimes, overseas sources are referred to, because still, at least there, the apparatus of formal authority are still in place. So you can write to Al-Azhar, you can write to Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, and these are people with formal qualifications, and they can give the answers. But a limited number of people, Muslims in America, have access to those bodies. And so for, large numbers of Muslims, the question of, who do I listen to, is a question that often goes unanswered. There are people who, through their writings, through their speeches, lectures, etc., have acquired a modicum of authority. I mean, their words are listened to on the understanding that they are right. But to go as far as looking at these persons as formal authorities, we're not yet at that point in American Islam.
So what do we do?
Depends on what you're looking for. Look, the problem is this: I could give you names of people who were trained at Al-Azhar, and have formal degrees in Islamic law, and who come to the United States, and they are formal shuyukh, all right, who give legal opinions that are totally wrong in the context of America. I can give you a concrete example. In classical Islamic law, of course, we know that Muslims have an obligation to attend Friday prayer. Classical Islamic law says, however, if for to no fault of your own, you are unable to go. So for example, if you have been incarcerated, all right, there is no blame on you for not going to Friday communal prayer. Okay? Fine. We come to America now, all right? The warden at some prison calls up this Azhar graduate and says, do Muslims who are incarcerated, are they obligated to attend Friday prayer? And he says what?
Yes.
No. And then the warden, therefore, shuts down Friday prayer in the prison for inmates. Now, this sheikh has no idea of the concept of reasonable accommodation. None. And through his fatwa, all right, Muslim inmates in American prisons may be denied the right to assemble for Friday prayer. So this person is an authority in some sense, but should he always be referred to as the go-to guy? Am I fielding or?
I like you fielding.
Oh, okay. Yes.
I don't know if I misunderstood you, but you said something about that there are those who serve up Islam as being part of the Enlightenment tradition.
No, what I said was that the Enlightenment tradition provides the context in which many of your questions are asked. And in that context, Muslims feel pressure to apologize
right.
rather than simply to explain.
Exactly. It's in that context, I guess, that the media operates.
Right.
So is there another context in which Islam should be understood, is my question. Is that possible? I mean, it's...
Well, I think, well, two things. I think it is possible. I mean, those of you who are in the media, I'm not going to bore you or try to impress you, you know, by quoting this Mattingly article and all these kinds of things, but I think that there are certain things that could be done within the industry itself on the one hand. On the other hand, however, if the media is going to pursue an understanding of Islam that puts it in conversation with secular ideology, on the one hand, the question has to be asked whether or not that's going to be done with all religious traditions, and Muslims feel that sometimes there's a slight double standard there. And then second, are Muslim explanations then always going to fetch the label of extreme?
But I guess I think I understand what you're saying. It's interesting that it seems that there's this constant, there's this tendency to restore Islam to these norms, these Enlightenment norms that reflect Western values, always, even in so-called positive representations of Islam in the press here.
Well, let me say this much. I mean, and because my perspective on much of this is that in its best tradition, the American project is one in which the meaning of being American is that it's best when it's in contention, and when we start talking about Western values, I happen to believe that black people in America are among the most Western. All right, but clearly. They have outlooks, perspectives, and ideas that are not quite consistent with sort of the what you might refer to as Western notions. So I think that one of the things that can be done is to complicate a little bit this whole category of Western. It's not a monolith. I mean, there are many narratives. There are many historical narratives. There are many repositories of mythologies in America, all right, that are equally Western. But when it comes to, I mean... We become, I mean, almost hyper-enlightenment when it comes to looking at Islam, but not when it comes to looking at Catholicism. And we don't look at Catholicism and say, well, when are you going to get a woman up there and giving a mass? But when it comes to Islam, I mean, so I think that, and the Catholics are, I think, pretty Western, would you? That's the point that I'm making.
say the mass, but to do the other stuff in the church.
No, I mean, how the Catholics proceed is their business. I'm not trying to affect the outcome of the discourse. But what I'm talking about is the set of presuppositions that you as a journalist go in with. I mean, what standard are you holding Muslims to? And is it the same standard to which you're holding Catholics? I mean, talk about polygyny and things like that. We don't talk about Mormons, I read articles, you know, about other religious communities in the newspapers, and I have to ask myself, boy, this guy were a Muslim? What would they be saying about Islam? I mean, I think a month or 6 weeks ago, there was an article in the New York Times about a Jewish rabbi who there's a ritual in Judaism where the rabbi kisses the genitals of the child. It's part of the... Did anybody see that? And he was passing genital herpes virus. And there was a story in the New York Times about it. And, whoa! What if this guy were a Muslim? I mean, what would be said about Islam? So I think that you're right. I mean, there is this we are where we are in our history in terms of our relationship to the Enlightenment. Okay, but I don't think that America is as monolithic in terms of the way that it relates to that. I mean, as the media often assumes when it comes to talking to Muslims. I mean, Americans are religious. Yes?
I would respectfully take issue with that. I think that not all of what you said, but I think those questions do come up about Catholicism and Protestantism. I think those questions do come up from journalists often about how they fit into the constitutional system that we have, the rationalistic perspective that we have as a nation. I don't generally ask Catholics or Southern Baptists if they would commit terrorist acts against America, nor do I ask Muslims. But I would say from imams to young Muslims, school-age Muslims, I've had many of them volunteer to me, we are not terrorists, and the media consistently paint us with that brush.
Well, let me ask you this. How many Catholics volunteer to you, I'm not gay and I'm not a pedophile? I'm not saying that. I don't mean to be offensive, but you understand the point that I'm trying to make. They have not been in a position where they feel that they have to volunteer that kind of information. Right. But Muslims do.
Right, and you made that clear earlier that there is this conciliation that Muslims tend automatically to make at times.
Well, it's not automatic. I don't think that. I mean, Muslims are not looking for ways. You don't get so many blessings for the number of times you declare you're not a terrorist. I mean, that's a part of the social political context in which they live. And what Muslims are, I mean, I think what one of the tests perhaps of the journalistic community would be this. To what extent do Muslims read your papers to find out about themselves? I would argue very rarely. And in the majority of cases, Muslims read the papers to find out what they are saying about us and how they are presenting our religion to the rest of society. And I think that there's something mildly wrong with that picture.
I don't disagree.
I think we have time for one more question.
They've all deferred, so be nice.
I wanted to sort of take you back to the historical part of your talk and ask you, in the pre-modern period that you were discussing, how the jurists at that time were able to disseminate what they were deciding. Why, I guess I want a clearer picture of why those centuries were so important to what we are to who we're talking to now, or why you think they're so important, and also how that came across to, on the ground to Muslims at that point.
Well, if I understand your question fully, I mean, part of what you're asking is an anthropological question, which is a whole PhD dissertation about, you know, about why certain things take hold when they do. The short and simple answer to your question would be for the same reason that we are not obsessed with, but we take an interest in the period of the founding fathers of America in terms of coming to some kind of understanding of both who we are and who we should be. We are in constant conversation with that period of history in order to determine whether we are moving in directions that are consistent with what we say we are and what we aspire to be or not. And I think that that sacred period of sacred history that I talked about sort of plays the same role in Islamic or in Muslim sort of social psychology, as it were.
I was just going to bounce off of what you just asked. Is there a historical reason why it's three generations from the time of the Prophet that's the period of sacred
history? No, I mean, there are all kinds of things that develop that we don't even know why. I mean, the development of the schools of law. Why they develop, when they develop, and where, we don't really know. The answer. But this is a period that Muslims look back to as being the golden period of Islam, where, again, the normative understandings of religion were produced. That's in law, that's in theology, that's in mysticism to a lesser degree. But that is the period of sacred history in which, if I am to determine myself to be a Muslim today, I have to do that to some extent or another in conversation with that history. And I think that progressives, women's groups, are finding out the hard way that you can ignore that sacred history and you can put forth a view and it may catch on for a while. But it's not likely to have much permanency unless it sort of authenticates itself in conversation with that history. That's my opinion. There are some who disagree with me, but they're wrong.
Can I ask you one final question? Why hasn't that American Sikh Council that you resigned from been able to fill this void of authority, at least within the American community?
Well, I think that, by the way, I mean, I resigned from that Sikh Council. I'm not opposed to Sikh Councils. And I believe that we have a serious need for a Fiqh Council, not in an effort to homogenize, to sort of Fordize and you know, make American Islam one size fits all, but fatwas are not binding instruments, they're voluntary instruments. And I believe that for Muslims who want guidance, there should be a reliable body of jurisprudential thought that can give them answers. The answers are voluntary anyway. And I believe that we need such a body in America. And in fact, one of the other members who also resigned, we were talking about, well, we still need a Fiqh Council. Just that one sort of, in our estimation, misunderstood its mission. The Fiqh Council has to remain above the fray. It cannot get politicized. It cannot give in to ethnic, racial, or class favoritism. It must remain above the fray. And it must do so in order to be able to command the respect and the assent of the rank and file.
And it doesn't have that, I guess.
Well, when you give fatwas on the tsunami and fatwas on Katrina,
thank you.